Thank you for coming. Thanks for the warm welcome. Lots of familiar faces out there, and thanks very much for coming to this. I've sat on grass like that at events like this, and it's really no fun at all. So I'm with you, and there's something I can't avoid, something that I'm sure all of you saw when you walked in, which is poverty is about three comfortable seats at the front that are hardly being used, and you guys all sitting on the ground. So all I'm saying is I'm conscious of that. And if anyone wanted to, I'm not going to stop you. I'm going to talk for 40 minutes or so, and then you're going to ask me questions and say wiser things than I've said for 20 minutes or so, and then we're done. Okay. The 1992 novel, also a 1996 film, The English Patient, is set in Egypt during the Second World War. A married English woman, Catherine, finds herself often alone as her husband pursues a cartographical expedition. She falls in love with an impossibly exotic Hungarian nobleman, Laszlo. Count Laszlo, another cartographer, discovers a wondrous cave decorated with prehistoric paintings deep in the Sahara Desert. Laszlo and Catherine fall into a passionate affair. Catherine's husband, sensing the affair, plans a murderous revenge. He puts Catherine in the back seat of his biplane and flies toward Count Laszlo's excavation camp near the famous cave. He tries to land the plane right on Laszlo himself, but the plan catastrophically backfires. It turns out it's Catherine's husband who dies in the crash. Laszlo, the intended target, sustains only minor injuries, but Catherine's badly hurt. We witness Laszlo carrying her slowly and lovingly to the prehistoric cave. Now, Laszlo and Catherine face an unspeakable predicament. Catherine's injuries are life-threatening. If she's going to live, Laszlo's going to need to go and find medical help. But that means going to Cairo, and Cairo is 3 days' walk away. It's a dangerous journey. Even if Laszlo gets there unscathed, there may be no one he can persuade to bring help. And even if all these ifs meet happy whens, there's got to be only a small chance Catherine will still be alive when Laszlo gets back. What are they to do? I believe this is the defining question of our time, and tonight I want to explain why. I'm going to start with a very big question indeed. What is the essential problem of human existence? I want to dig inside this question to identify the answer most educated Western people would probably offer to such a question. I want not just to name this answer, but to explore it in such a way that we can see how this answer shapes a number of things that we do. Here's my hypothesis. The operational assumption of late modernity has long been that the central problem of human existence is mortality. From the moment we come into the world, our fundamental crisis is that we're going to die. In the words of Samuel Beckett, we give birth astride of a grave, the light gleams an instant, then it's night once more. Given that eternity is rather extensive by anyone's measure, any limited lifespan that falls short of eternity is bound to be unsatisfactory. And 80 years are not inherently less adequate than 1,000,000 or 2. As Isaac Watts, recalling the words of 2 Peter, reminds us, 1,000 ages in thy sight are like an evening gone, short as the watch that ends the night before the rising sun. But the issue is not simply that life is limited in terms of duration. Human flourishing is circumscribed by a host of other limitations. If we simply invoke 9, we might note disability, chronic ill health and terminal illness, poverty, hardship and malnutrition, adverse weather, famine and limited natural resources. It's a formidable list. We're hemmed in on all sides, not just by death, but by a host of other constraints. What's changed in perhaps the last 50 or 60 years is that, at least in the West, humanity no longer feels such limitations are integral to its existence. There was a time when death and taxes named the unshiftable givens of human experience, and that life was a largely stoic matter of learning to live within the boundaries of limited human potential. Death took place in the home, most illnesses had little or no chance of a cure, and it was best to prepare oneself for a fragile existence or face hubristic disappointment or humiliation. The world's resources, of course, held enormous potential, but the technology and techniques for tapping that potential were still in their infancy. But those days have gone. A cascade of technological advance in fields such as medicine, transport, and information transfer has made constraints seem absurd rather than necessary. The human project is no longer about coming to terms with limitations and flourishing within them. It's now almost without question about overcoming and transcending limitations. Human contingency is to be swept aside like racist legislation during the civil rights movement. It's not something that one learns to live with, it's something one expects to conquer. Doing so is part of human self-assertion, human full expression, the spreading of humanity's wings. It has more or less become the defining project of the human race. It seems all are agreed that the key project of our species is the alleviation, overcoming, and transcendence of mortality. We achieve this by inventing medicines, discovering new dimensions of experience, reducing or reversing limitations such as blindness, breaking athletic records, and circumventing such tragedies as famine or muscular dystrophy. That's what we strive for. That's what gains outstanding individuals rewards and acclaim. That is what our culture prizes most highly. Our society celebrates nothing more than the overcoming of limitation in sport, science, and communications and health. Every invention, every new world record, every new gadget is a sacrament of the deepest human desire of our age, to become free by transcending limitation and thus, for a moment, believing we can withstand even death. Think about the Paralympics in London 2 years ago. They enriched the human project. For many people, the Paralympics are redefining sport. No longer is sport simply about excellence and making sacrifices and being better than others. Now sport is primarily a celebration of overcoming obstacles and adversity and thus opening a door to independence and freedom. In other words, sport has ceased to be an enjoyable diversion from the central quest of humankind. It has instead become the definitive embodiment of that central human project. In the Middle Ages, the most celebrated cultural moments were the discovery of precious documents from the classical period. Each one represented a reclaiming of a piece of and an avenue into a lost golden era. Today, the golden moments are the transcending of another dimension of human limitation. When we advertise our organisations, we seldom still say making lead pencils the same way for 150 years. Instead, we say testing and stretching the boundaries of knowledge, making the impossible possible. The single notion that sums up this sense of throwing off limitations is freedom, and the term we employ to commodify freedom and give it retail value is choice. So the basic line in promoting what we do is to say our product or service overcomes one or more of the real or perceived constraints of our daily or lifelong existence and thus gives us more choice. Wealth has thus come to be perceived as depth and breadth of choice. Poverty, by contrast, comes to mean the dearth of choice. It's instructive to consider the powerful metaphors that govern perceptions of poverty. For the sake of simplicity, I'm going to divide those metaphors into two kinds, metaphors of deficit and metaphors of dislocation. So I'm going to give you three metaphors of deficit and three metaphors of dislocation. So let's start with metaphors of deficit. Let's consider, first of all, the notion of poverty as desert. The desert metaphor assumes people are poor because they do not have enough. They don't have enough money, food, good relationships, skills, education. This isn't really anyone's fault. It's more a problem of scarcity of resources or poor distribution. The solution is to give people more. In the short term, more money, or in a material economy, more nutritious food and clean water. in the long term, more education, more training in healthy work and family patterns, more stable institutions, more access to credit and outlets for their skills. There are two things to note at the outset about the desert metaphor. The first is that it's the most widely held. It's the most widely held because it's the most easily grasped conceptually. People do not have enough. Because it most easily plays into the agreeable notion that poverty can be fixed by transferring resources from those who have enough and to spare, perhaps even too much, and because it doesn't require a narrative of blame or a diagnosis of structural injustice. The second thing to note about it is that it's seriously flawed, both descriptively and in terms of the outworking of policies for which it becomes the basis. The desert metaphor doubtless motivates many non-poor to active involvement in relief and development, but invariably encourages a quasi-colonial attitude that misses people's humanity. It's inclined to assume an us and them, where we are defined by what we have and they are defined by what they lack. The reality is that on a global scale, food aid can have a destructive effect on the economy of the recipient nation and contribute to more hunger and poverty in the long term. Free, subsidized, or cheap food tends to undercut local farmers who can't compete and are driven out of jobs and into poverty, further enhancing the market share of the larger global producers. Many poor nations are dependent on farming, and so such food aid amounts to food dumping. Suspicions abound that the more powerful nations have increasingly used this as a foreign policy tool for dominance rather than for real aid. What seems to be going on is that rich nations simply use aid as a lever to open poor country markets to their products. The goodwill that appears to be embodied in aid is undermined by the way protectionism simultaneously denies market access for poor country products. The result is that aid enhances dependence while routes to economic stability are blocked. The desert metaphor ends up underwriting a system that benefits the donor economically while increasing the donor's reputation for benevolence. Thus does ill-informed compassion quickly translate into withering cynicism. Another metaphor of deficit, this is the second one, is that of poverty as defeat. Life is a competition, so the argument goes, some win and some lose. The poor are simply those who lose. They were perhaps dealt a tough hand from bad luck, bad genes, a bad background, or a bad environment. They maybe lived in the wrong country, faced the wrong climate, or found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or some would say they didn't make the most of their opportunities. Everyone, it's sometimes maintained, has the same chance. It's tough, and those with skill and application make it. This view tends to come with a strong emphasis on personal responsibility. It's often pointed out that if everyone were given an average person's annual salary at the start of a week, patterns of trade, barter, saving and profligacy, leaving aside criminality, would mean that a significant number would be destitute by the weekend. In this view, tax and welfare increase poverty by taking away incentives for effort while punishing those who succeed. A certain almost punitive streak is necessary in response to national and international poverty, because the best way to perceive poverty is as a backs-to-the-wall stimulus to initiative, courage, energy, and imagination in finding sources of income, particularly entrepreneurial commercial ones. Needless to say, this assumes a global movement of labour that's seldom in fashion in wealthier economies. But it's worth noting a philosophical assumption that lies inside the defeat metaphor. The notion that all may avoid defeat. Can all succeed? The way to preserve an affirmative answer to this question is to infer that poverty indicates moral failure. If people had kept their marriages, families, jobs, and local network together, all would be well. To illustrate this point, one need only reflect on the associations in North Atlantic culture of the word loser. The term blends moral, social, and circumstantial failure. Perhaps a deeper dimension of the defeat metaphor, particularly in this moral guise, is the impulse to find an explanation for all ills in the stars or in ourselves. There seems to be no such thing as an ill that doesn't have a culprit. A third metaphor of deficit, but this time with less of an odour of judgment, is that of poverty as dragnet. You got the idea, they all start with D. The picture is here is of a trap door, like a cat flap. It's easy to fall into, but escape is impossible. In a dragnet, fish are pressed so tightly against the net and each other that they can't wriggle free. Geoffrey Sachs, in his book The End of Poverty, speaks of the inability of very poor countries to reach what he calls the bottom rung of the ladder of economic development, and the trap that closes in when the population is growing faster than capital is being accumulated. He defines the poverty trap like this. The poor start with a very low level of capital per person and then find themselves trapped in poverty because the ratio of capital per person actually falls from generation to generation. The amount of capital per person declines when the population is growing faster than capital is being accumulated. Sachs's solution is what he calls clinical economics. The phrase is extraordinarily telling. This is intervention with medical degrees of precision. In Sachs's view, sufficient foreign aid, around 0.7%, can make up for the lack of capital in poor countries, raising the stock of capital up to lift families above mere survival. This is the philosophy of the 8 Millennium Development Goals, the implementation group of which Sachs chaired for 3 years up until 2005. Okay, so those are the first three metaphors, and now we're going to move to the second slate of metaphors of dislocation. So the first of those is what we might call the dungeon. The dungeon metaphor sees the problem as about not scarcity, but sin. Poverty is a kind of incarceration. The poor are kept in poverty by a widening circle of exploiters, by the local non-poor, who siphon off resources and benefits that were intended for the disadvantaged, by local authorities who use blackmail and violence to rob the poor, and by local employers and traders who use their strong bargaining position to force economically vulnerable people to sell their goods and labour below market value. Conversely, some see poverty as a prison in which people put themselves, either by passive characteristics such as laziness or lack of ambition, or by more active destructive tendencies such as reckless behaviour or substance addiction. The dungeon is in many ways a reaction to the desert metaphor. It tends to be favoured by those who are disillusioned or angry about the naivety of the imagery of desert. It shifts the emphasis from resources to relationships. It undoubtedly motivates many social justice and evangelistic responses, generally of a more sophisticated kind than desert approaches. However, it shares something significant with the desert metaphor. It's still dominated by the external application of a solution. Thus, it can get so caught up in social theory or theological paternalism that it can miss people's specific humanity just as much as the desert metaphor does. It can easily overlook the extraordinary ingenuity required to live in poverty and demonstrated by those poor people who survive. A second metaphor of dislocation, went at number 5 out of 6 here, in case you were getting anxious, is that of disease. A disease is a condition with a non-human root, cause, and physical, mental, social, and spiritual symptoms, which nonetheless requires a very human response in every dimension. This metaphor regards poverty as a kind of sickness. Sickness is usually not something a person is born with, but something they can quickly pick up from those around them. Sickness lies fundamentally in relationships, communities, and societies rather than in individuals. Like any other disease, that response is sometimes aimed at identifying and facilitating a cure and sometimes focused on continuing to care when a cure is not perceivable. Either way, it's about balancing the general characteristics of the disease with its particular manifestation in each person and community and realizing that physical change is only part of an ecology of relational, spiritual, and communal dimensions of healing. Sickness is a compromise between the metaphors of desert and dungeon. Unlike the dungeon metaphor, the language of disease isn't about blame, but unlike the desert language, it takes the complexity of poverty seriously. Thus, disease language hints that poverty in some of its dimensions can afflict even the circumstantially rich. A third metaphor of dislocation is that of desolation. This picture is less preoccupied with causes and more with symptoms. It perceives geographical, social, and economic isolation. It recognizes that women perform 2/3 of the world's work, earn 1/10 of the world's income, are 2/3 of the world's illiterate, and own less than 1/100 of the world's property. It identifies with people who live in substandard housing with inadequate sanitation, who lack the regular means to feed themselves, with little or no land, livestock, or spare cash, who don't get enough nutritious food to give them energy and help them fight off infections, who often don't live near places where goods are bought and sold or places where capital or credit are available, who find what money they're able to save is likely to be blown away by obligatory cultural rites of passage, and who live so close to the edge that a natural disaster could force them to sell what few assets they have simply to secure short-term survival. These are often people who have no relationships in which they can trust and experience the fraying of domestic, extended family and community ties, resulting in vulnerability to the forces of exploitation, the moneylender, the protection racketeer, the merciless landlord, the bogus holy man, the drug dealer. Many or most of these conditions can apply to disadvantaged people in the West as well. In such a situation, it's hard for anyone to identify what's gone wrong, and it's hard for anyone to identify exactly what a willing person could do to help. Okay, I've offered 6 metaphors that grip the imagination of debates about poverty, but what I want to highlight is the broad distinction between 2 kinds of metaphors. On the one hand, there are metaphors of deficit, which see the problem as a lack of resource, of wisdom, application, skill, or education. On the other hand, there are metaphors of dislocation, which see the issues as more about a breakdown in or strain on relationships, health, or community. These 2 strands name different anthropologies, different notions of aid and development, different notions of sin and redemption, different understandings of public policy, and different perceptions of the church's mission. It's time to explore the dimensions of those differences. These 6 metaphors of poverty are significant because they all presuppose a view on the fundamental predicament of human existence. Each of the first 3 metaphors largely assumes that the fundamental human problem is mortality, and thus directs the great majority of our endeavour toward creating opportunities for people to overcome the world's limitations and their own. I'm suggesting that educated people in Western culture generally assume the fundamental human problem is mortality, specifically, and human limitation more generally. Poverty is taken to be an extreme case of the limitations inherent in the human condition, an extreme constraint of freedom. But this brings us to the heart of the issue. What if it turned out that the fundamental human predicament wasn't mortality after all? What if it turned out that poverty wasn't basically about limitation? What if it turned out that all along the fundamental human problem and the central factor in poverty was isolation? What if the answer for Laszlo doesn't lie in walking to Cairo? What do I mean by this? If the fundamental human problem is isolation, then the responses we're looking for don't lie in the laboratory or the hospital or the frontiers of human knowledge or experience. Instead, the responses lie in things we already have, most of all in one another. Let me explain this by asking a basic theological question. Why do Christians, to use conventional and familiar language, want people to be saved? An obvious answer might be because those people are going to die and maybe they'll go to hell or oblivion or nothingness or whatever the latest term for downstairs happens to be. But if one says, and what's so great about going to heaven then? What kind of an answer do you get? Heaven is the state of being with God and being with one another and being with the renewed creation. That's to say, heaven is not simply a matter of continued being. What matters is that that continued being is being with. In other words, a heaven that's simply and only about overcoming mortality is an eternal life that's not worth having. It's not worth having because it leaves one alone forever. And being alone forever is not a description of heaven, it's a description of hell. There's no value in being unless it's being with. There's no value in existence unless it's existence in relationship, with God, with one another, and the creation. The heaven that's worth aspiring to is a rejoining of such relationship, a restoration of community, a discovery of partnership, a sense of being in the presence of another in which there's neither a folding of identities that loses their difference nor a sharpening of difference that leads to hostility, but an enjoyment of the other that evokes cherishing and relishing. The theological word for this is communion. If we look at that second set of metaphors of poverty, the ones I called metaphors of dislocation, we find dungeon, disease, and desolation. These are all fundamentally about the breakdown of relationship. They're not about limitation and mortality. They're about underusing and misusing the gift of one another. They don't presuppose scarcity, competition, and conflict. They open the imagination to limitless possibility in restored connection. So I've argued that Western culture assumes the fundamental human problem is mortality, that the fundamental human problem isn't mortality, but is instead isolation, and that in the case of poverty, the metaphors that dominate the discourse can be broadly separated into those that presuppose mortality and those that presuppose isolation. Now, I want to show why this distinction between mortality and isolation is so crucial to the church's mission. It's not difficult to see how a philosophy based on overcoming mortality and a philosophy based on overcoming isolation can come into tension with one another. As humanity's quest to overcome mortality has gathered pace, the degree of human isolation has increased with it. For sure, enhanced transportation, telecommunications, and information technology have made it possible to communicate in ever more extensive and complex ways. But they've also facilitated lifestyles where people are in touch with conversation partners on the other side of the planet, but not with next-door neighbours, where insurance lies in investments and pensions rather than in friendships and extended families, and where face-to-face human interaction is ceasing to become the encounter of choice for a generation who are used to having plentiful alternative ways to make themselves known to one another. The flip side of making ourselves more independent and self-sufficient is that we're simultaneously becoming more isolated and more alone. And this brings me to the crucial point. If you see the central quest of life as being to overcome isolation rather than to overcome mortality, your notion of mission will change accordingly. Mission that seeks to overcome isolation does not look to technology to solve problems and reduce limitations. It does not assume that its own knowledge and skill are the crucial element required to change the game. Of course, if you're in the business of overcoming mortality, you're going to need plenty of knowledge and skill. But if you're in the business of overcoming isolation, then you begin to appreciate that concentrating on enhancing and promoting your own knowledge and skill may be as likely to be counterproductive as to be productive. In Ephesians, Paul cites one compelling metaphor for what Christ has done in bringing salvation. Paul says, "In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall, that is, the hostility between us." Paul is referring to the hostility between Jew and Gentile, but the point goes for any such degree of antagonism and alienation. Indeed, the greater the degree of isolation or antagonism, the more profound the significance of overcoming it. Thus, mission becomes recognizing those from whom one is alienated and antagonized, and seeking and finding ways to be present to them. Mission is not primarily using one's skills in conflict resolution to bring peace between warring parties, but instead perceiving contexts in which one is one of the warring parties and submitting oneself to a process of making peace. The approach that sees overcoming mortality as the goal tends to approach mission like this. We, as outsiders to disadvantage and distress, and thus not in any significant way part of the problem, nonetheless have expert eyes to see what the problem is and ready-made solutions at hand. We will appear in the local context, deliver our solution, and then withdraw quickly to resume our regular activities, which are not considered to have any material bearing, positive or negative, on the problem we have identified and resolved. If we've listened and learned from repeated interventions of this kind, we'll have gathered that it's good to form relationships on the ground, good to involve local participants in some way, else local wisdom be neglected and local goodwill be needlessly undermined. But the point is that this local participation is never more than a means to an end. The end is never in question. The end always comes in the form of overcoming the limitations of the local environment or skill base and the provision of technology or the enhancement of the capacity to use it. Contrast this with the kind of mission that emerges from a conviction that the goal is to overcome isolation. We're not exactly sure what the problem is, but we take for granted that we are a part of it. We do not assume that the solution is to make other people more like us by ensuring that they have what we have and live as we live. We take it for granted that we have a deficiency, and we presume that deficiency is due to the poverty or absence of our relationship with those who have important and invigorating things to share with us, if only we could open up channels to receive those things. We may well embark on projects that seek to alleviate distress or transfer resources or develop skills. But the point of these projects is not to achieve a specific material goal. These endeavours are simply means of forming relationships from a safe common starting point. These programmes are ladders that will fall away once the relationships are in place and genuine dialogue is happening. What we might call the mortality model insists that what's required is the introduction of new information, new technique, new technology. The isolation model asserts that in most cases, a people or a neighborhood already has almost everything it needs for its own redemption. What inhibits such redemption is the energy lost in isolation and wasted in antagonism. The identification of isolation as an alternative to mortality and the distinction between metaphors of deficit and metaphors of dislocation together yield an irony that I've been trying to highlight. And that irony is this. Those initiatives in mission that generally begin with a deficit notion of poverty and assume the human predicament is mortality and limitation have a tendency of actually increasing isolation. In all the haste to provide technology and enhance technique and alleviate the limitations of climate or scarcity or skill, mortality-motivated service can often underline and even enhance the kinds of social alienation that, from the isolation perspective, constitute the problem in the first place. To return to poverty, in the understanding I'm following, poverty is not fundamentally about the absence of money or about the lack of conventional forms of power. It's about the impoverishment, the instrumentalization, the manipulation, the breakdown, or the perversion of relationship. For sure, poverty diminishes human dignity, and human dignity is often taken to be a fundamental matter whose upholding needs no advocacy. But notice again that the quest to assert and affirm human dignity may have the unanticipated side effect or the less explicit implication of leaving people alone and reinforcing their isolation. There's something more fundamental than detached dignity. And that is the enrichment of genuine and enhancing relationships. There's no way of simply providing those relationships for people. A notion of mission predicated on mortality and limitation risks becoming a form of technology that seeks to make a better world without us needing to become better people. A kind of device that seeks to rescue people without the bothersome business of relationships. All that such initiatives can do is to facilitate circumstances and conditions in which crucial relationships can begin, take root, grow, and thrive. Such initiatives can address mortality and limitation, but they cannot overcome isolation. Finally, let me return to the English patient. I began with Laszlo's choice of whether to stay beside Catherine and be her companion in her last hours, or walk to Cairo in search of assistance. In the story, Laszlo scarcely thinks twice before he sets off on his three-day journey to find help. He has all sorts of adventures before he finally makes it back to the encampment and the ancient cave. And when he does, Catherine is very, very dead. Laszlo is so committed to believing that there is a solution to Catherine's agonizing plight and that he has the solution that he overlooks the one thing needful, and that is being with Catherine. He's so concerned to solve the problem that he leaves her alone in her hour of greatest need. Could it possibly be that the real reason Laszlo went to Cairo was because he couldn't bear to watch Catherine die? Is not Western late modernity a culture in which we fill our lives with activity and creativity and productivity because we fear if we sat still we'd go to pieces? What Catherine needed was the man she loved to be with her as she faced the near certainty of her own impending death. But Laszlo did not, or maybe could not, give her what she needed. We're turning our world into a Laszlo society, full of products, gadgets, devices, techniques, energy, all of which make the world go round very effectively, and the result is that we've all become Laszlo. Yet the irony of the film is that when Laszlo, returning to Cairo with Catherine's body, crashes another plane and is himself horribly injured, he is found in the desert and carefully extracted from the wreckage and tenderly accompanied by strangers who then care for him until the point of his own death. He receives from strangers, at the end of his life, the patient love he's unable to give to Catherine at the end of hers. Can we, in the face of every pressure from our culture and our day, learn from his parable and come to be wiser than him? Thank you. Thank you very much. We've got 20 minutes, so I suggest we spend the first 45 seconds just talking to somebody next to us to see if you can home in on something that was particularly pertinent for you, and then we'll do the usual business of a lovely assistant passing a microphone round. Okay, that's enough chat. Who's first?
Thank you so much for that. Your taxonomy of the human condition was very instructive. But I'm left with the question, from the corner of Trafalgar Square, where is local? Where do you see constructive relationship?
I have to say, we get very lazy at St. Martin the Fields because the world comes to us. And we don't need to spend a lot of time angsting in small groups. I'm thinking of the sort of the Not the 9 o'clock News caricature sort of Marxist thing where they're all reading the, you know, the Communist Manifesto and so on, and then they decide, I'll just forget all this and let's go out and, you know, save the world. But you know, one of the issues that was troubling me and one of my colleagues about 18 months ago was that we're just full of asylum seekers and failed asylum seekers sleeping in the church through the day because they've been on overnight buses all night, whatever. And for various reasons I probably shouldn't go into in a public setting like this, our homeless charity isn't always in a position to help those people. So particularly, you know, if they're basically illegal. At the same time, myself and a colleague felt that something had happened to St. Martin's that probably is a phenomenon that many of us tend to familiar with, which is we'd got so professionalized and taken up with health and safety and 50 other things with the charitable work that we wondered if we were really doing this Laszlo and Catherine stuff that for me is the heart of it all. We were doing a bit more working for and not so much being with, if you understand that kind of terminology. So we started doing a Sunday afternoon ministry where half a dozen congregation people are available. There's some hot food, there's some showers available, there's some washing machines if people want to use them. And about 40 or so of these, almost entirely men, come along and have the best time of their week, just playing chess and hanging out. And it's I see it as a kind of an isolation overcoming, you know, because as soon as you start doing this kind of thing, people say, oh, have you got solicitors? You know, have you got health professionals? Have you got all the people that can work for and work with? And we say, we might get to that. But that's not what this is about. This is about discovering when you get into that setting that actually there's a guy there who used to be a hairdresser but can't get a job as a hairdresser because he's illegal. He doesn't mind cutting the hair of the other guys. So it's not me with my magnificent professional hairdressing skills that I learned in seminary because I wanted to do that extra course. It's creating a space where people can find the abundance of their own gifts, which have, you know, which sleeping on an overnight bus no one would ever know about. So, I mean, in a sense, I actually find it easier to identify with my neighborhood at St. Martin in the Fields than I've been when I've been a parish priest of a conventional parish, because it really does come and knock on your door. You don't actually have to go and find it. In that sense, this is the easiest parish job I've ever done, because the hard part is knocking on a door and not knowing the stranger behind it, and I do almost none of that now. The strangers all come and knock on mine.
Thanks for a wonderful talk. It kind of reminded me of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where you've got the difference between deficit needs and relationship needs. And I wonder whether there needs to be such a sharp distinction between them. And you know, hunger will kill you quicker than loneliness, and maybe both of them need addressing.
Yes, I mean, yes and no. Clearly, you know, I'm making a rhetorical point by distinguishing between the two, but it's a rhetorical point that I believe is borne out incredibly widely, and particularly in my experience of what you might call, what I've called today mission, but certainly from my 7 years living in the States, would be the culture of secularized religion that's called service that has completely taken over the American college campus, in which you've got 6 weeks in the summer. It's been paid for by a posh alumnus who, and the university's been through a scandal about something or other, and the posh alumnus wants to improve the image of the university and pays for this fantastic scheme in which these you know, very intelligent kids don't go and do an internship on Wall Street. What a huge sacrifice for the summer. Instead, they go to Tanzania and build 13 wells. And then, of course, 10 years later, they go back and they find that no one's used this wells. And what do? They get very angry with the Tanzanians. Nobody asked the Tanzanians if they wanted any wells. No, you know, this kind of stuff. I mean, I'm giving a caricature, but it's actually sadly not really a caricature. And that's a classic kind of mortality versus relationship. And yet, and of course, the tragedy, and sort of those of you familiar with Mrs. Jellyby in Bleak House, and about how all her children were sort of bashing their heads against the wall while she was funding the missions in Borrioboola-Gha. I mean, it's a classic of that many of these American universities are set in cities which are racially very, very conflicted and don't have any mechanism to engage with those issues but go to Tanzania and build wells. So it's sadly, it's not a caricature. So we have versions of that in this country, not quite as stark in my experience. But I do believe that identifying that contrast is heuristic, you know, it enables us to sort of bring out of the shadows some points that really need to be made. And I think the point, I mean, if it doesn't sound too, I don't want to sort of jump on the point that you made, but in some ways you could argue that most forms of mortality stroke limitation, the kind that you described, someone dies quicker of thirst, or I can't remember exactly how you put it, are actually really isolation points in the end. You know, we're all babies who need others' work to feed us in the end. None of us could survive on the desert island. You know, we need networks entirely. So in that sense, I think isolation is fundamental. But it's a slight exaggeration, but it's an exaggeration that's got a boot behind it. I'll leave it up to you.
Thank you. That was fantastic. Just to say, we seem to be, because you're identifying this mortality issue mainly as a Western issue, and I agree with that. Because we seem to be exporting that hugely, how do we address that in ourselves and when we're working overseas? Because I guess many people do work overseas in situations. How do we address that exportation of the deficit mentality?
Well, I talk about, and I did in response to the first question, hint at this. I mean, I think of things in perhaps rather simplistic, but I find it very, very helpful to think in terms of four categories: working for, working with, and being for. And, you know, forgive me for those whom this touches on a raw nerve, being for is the blogger who tells everybody else they use the wrong language and, you know, says it's all about structural this and deconstructs that and the other, but actually never meets the destitute person face to face because they're writing their blog all the time. And, you know, working for is what I've described about building the stuff in Tanzania without ever asking. And working with is community organizing, and we all bring our different skills around, and Paulo Freire, conscientization for people who know that stuff, and, you know, energizing stuff. We're going to work on this together. We're going to conquer this thing together. And being with is more or less what I described in describing the Sunday afternoon ministry, hanging out, playing chess. We need all four, don't get me wrong. It's not like three are terrible and it's all about being with, but actually it is really. But no, actually it... We do need all four. You know, I go to the dentist, don't get me wrong, I want a working for relationship with my dentist. Don't even think about it. But we can only really function with these working for relationships if our life isn't completely overwhelmed by relationships in which every single one is us having the deficit and the other person having the solution. You know, most of us get satisfaction finding our own solutions. Being with is about creating environments where people can find their own solutions. So to me, being with is not always the opening sort of gambit in a relationship, but it's always the telos of the relationship. It's always where that relationship is finally going. Sometimes, you know, in terms of the hearts and minds language that's sometimes used about mixing military and humanitarian ends, that what's wrong with that for me is it clearly undermines trust, but it does so because it instrumentalizes being and working with for a working for purpose. In my view, that's completely the wrong way around. All our working for relationships are to create being with. So to use the most obvious example, having a baby. you know, having a baby, bringing up a child is obviously, for the first few years, almost entirely a working for relationship. But you're doing it to get to the point where the child has both independence and relationship. You're doing it to get to that magnificent point when they're in their 20s or whatever they are, when actually, I mean, of course, you know, later in life, as you know, many people know, it can change the other way around. But in the middle is this wonderful place where you can be with your, I mean, I wouldn't use the language of equality for reasons that will be, you know, might be clear from what I said in the talk, but reciprocity. And so I would say, my answer to your question is, how do we avoid making exactly these mistakes ourselves? Is take an account of all your professional and personal relationships and ask yourself, is my working for a way of getting to being with, or is it, like it was for Laszlo going to Cairo, a way of actually avoiding the necessity to be with? It's a great privilege to be in the fields because more than any other job I've done, I see every social class up from royalty down to the down to and everyone in between. But some of the people I see are people who are quite affluent and pay other people to look after their children. And the fascinating thing about this is that when that person comes home from work and the childminder is still there, as often as not, the childminder is still with the children and the parent is doing the dishwashing and the cooking. Because somehow it's actually easier to do the dishwashing and the cooking than it is to be with a child on the floor playing with the toys. But I would recommend doing that inventory of older relationships and saying which way this what's the telos of this relationship? It's working for is fine, but it's there to facilitate being with, because being with is heavenly, is eschatologically fulfilling. That's the way that God finally relates to us. And again, to put that on a right, this is a whole other talk, clearly, but it seems to me that to narrate salvation, you need to see it in those terms, that if you do use working for language about the cross, for example, about Jesus' cross and resurrection, it has to be working for language that facilitates being with God. That's what creation was. That's the teleological purpose of creation, to create in its circumstances in which God and us can be with one another. And so, you know, we all do our mini acts of creation every time we initiate a relationship or a project or whatever. The question is always, where's this going? Is this going towards being with? How long have we got? We got 5-10 minutes. Yeah.
Right. I just like to check what the new relationships that have to be made are when you consider poor communities. I was in for 12 years with one of the poorest communities in Liverpool, and the relationships between the people in those communities was very fine, but the relationship they had with the rest of society was totally alien, and they were the victims of the other people. But within the estate itself, there were some very wonderful relationships. So I was wondering if the relationship for a poor community like that you were thinking about redeeming, was the relationship with the rest of society and the rest of how the rest of society saw those people, rather than the relationships within that particular sort of group of people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and thrilled to hear Liverpool, because I started on this journey in the 80s in Liverpool myself, and so great to have a shout-out, as the Americans call it, for Liverpool. Yay. I don't know if people in this room, I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with ABCD, Asset-Based Community Development. But asset-based community development, John McKnight at the University of Northwestern University in Illinois, if you are among, you know, people say if you are one of those who pray, I'll say if you are one of those who Google, then look up ABCD. And I think John McKnight and his various collaborators have done about as good a job of expressing what you're expressing that I know. In other words, taking away, he talks about the way the system, as he calls it with a capital S, diminishes communities of the kind that you're describing by professionalizing everything. So, you know, when we have a bereavement, we need a professional person to go and talk to. We used to go and talk to our neighbors or friends Now we think, now they think, oh, don't waste my time, you should go and talk to a bereavement counsellor or something like that. Now, don't get me wrong, bereavement counsellors can be absolutely fantastic, but if that disempowers the community of one of its great assets, which is having good listening ears and wise old birds who've been through it all before, then actually that's a bit like when I was talking about the issue of flooding a developing world economy with cheap Western goods. It actually undermines that community. So I won't say much more about it now, but asset-based community development is, the simple best articulation of what it means for outsiders to have a role in seeing the community as the origin of the solution to its own problems, rather than as simply deficit which needs to be addressed by the wisdom that comes from outside. And I learned about this stuff when I helped to set up a development trust in the east of England during the New Deal for Communities era, late 90s. We got £35 million of government money. It was a community-led regeneration process. And then suddenly all these experts kind of flooded in, available from all over the country. Suddenly it's a bit like winning the lottery, and then suddenly all these financial advisors ring you up and say, oh, you've got a lot more money than you used to have and you probably want our help in... No! the whole point was that the community had all the wisdom it needs for its own flourishing. So thanks for making that point. John McKnight's your guy.
I think for me, the difference between isolation and
mortality
is something I've been sort of thinking about a long time, and the dislocation versus deficit model really crystallized for me a lot of the things you see on like Upworthy or kind of beautiful moments on like YouTube stuff of people being charitable towards each other. I find deeply disturbing, and I think that's why. So thank you for clearing that up. How can we begin to talk about this with other people who haven't heard you speak, for example? And also, how can we make sure that that we grab hold of this and develop in this kind of way of thinking, rather than going back to our old way of, as you said, it's very easy to just do the isolation thing and just, try and fix stuff.
Well, two or three answers to that, because it all depends on your own context. I do think for those who pray, I put the part about salvation in the talk for a reason. I think it comes down to the fundamental understanding of what Christianity is, what salvation means, what we actually think heaven looks like. I don't know about you, but when I talk to people who differ for me very greatly in the Christian faith or of other faiths or of no faith, I don't say, tell me what you don't believe about Christianity. I say, tell me what you do believe. And then keep pushing further and further. Tell me, no, but where? Okay, so we've been saved from our sins. Fine. What do we do then? Eternity seems like quite a while. What are we going to, is it going to be like Greenbelt forever? Just keep pushing along. Would that be, or is it always with strangers, or do we actually get to know everybody at Greenbelt as well as it, and then multiply that by billions? Is that the dream, that we have these close, intense, positive, affirming relationships with untold billions of people? Does that work? Keep going, and don't let people say, oh, that's too complicated. Just because they're talking about what they think salvation is. They should have a view on this. It's quite reasonable to ask the question. I'm asking the question. I am genuinely interested if I'm going to discover something I don't know. But I'm also kind of, my agenda, you'll know after listening to me for half an hour today, my agenda is to say it's about being with. It's about restored relationships. There isn't anything else in all creation in the end apart from restored relationship. That's what the Trinity is. It's relationship. And so for those who pray, that I would start with a theological question. I think the other way to learn is self-knowledge. Look me in the eyes. Tell me about what has been your most satisfying. Give me three of the most satisfying experiences you've had in the last 5 years. And I betcha all the jewelry on display in this tent tonight that the answers will be some kind of overcoming of adversity, probably with a team, or some sense of, you know, if you ask somebody, when did you feel closest to God? The chances are, you know, it's not when, you know, my son went and won the national championships or, you know, please, but no. You know, it's not that. It's actually when I was in the hospital and my mother was dying and I felt that sense of being together. So those are the two answers you tend to get, because I've done this a lot of times. And you get either we overcame this together, or even though we failed, somebody died, you know, the sickness continued, I was bonded with that person more deeply in adversity than I ever had been in the good times. So they're both with things. They're not about, that fantastic time I went to the dentist and my tooth felt a whole lot better afterwards. You know, so in other words, if actually it doesn't feel that great to be on the receiving end of a working for experience, then the food bank is not the ultimate apogee, the top of the mountain. But it's still worth doing the food bank, because the food bank gets you into the conversation, which then leads you to the real relationship. And if you never did the food bank, you probably never had the conversation. So, I mean, I would say the two ways to take this stuff forward is firstly talk about God, and then talk about yourself and reflect on your own experience and what's truly, transformed you. And it isn't stuff that other people have done for you. It's stuff that, with other people, you've done for yourself, or times when you felt profoundly bonded to somebody else. And you think, well, if that's the case, then our mission is to help other people have those experiences, which can't be just dolloped on them. We have to create fertile environments where people can have those experiences themselves. And that's what being with is all about. I think that's probably about it. Thanks, everybody.